I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back.
We're about to have a conversation with Simon Schama, who's written a wonderful new volume called The History of the Jews, Finding the Words, 1000 B.C. to 1492 A.D. He's written so many numerous books that many of us have read, Scribble, 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 The American Future of History, and many more. And this is also a series being made into a series for PBS. It's actually being done now. And Simon Schama, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hi. Hello.
So first question, why is the title B.C. and not B.C.E.?
Oh, I was ordered to do that. By, it was an executive decision taken by my publishers, and I was too timorous to resist. I think the extraordinary thing is, you know, if I had my druthers, it would be B.C.E. and C.E. But, oh, I don't know, in Britain, you know, it's loaded, and it sort of assumes you're being academically obscure if you do it the new way. But, I'm not taking the Fifth Amendment exactly, but my publishers ought to, actually, because I would be happy either way. So, I didn't put up a fight.
I just had to ask. Subtitle of the book actually really is, in right. some ways, the subtext of the entire book, which is just
yeah.
the notion that this is a history of a people of words. This is
yes, that's right.
This is part of the survival.
Yes, at the heart of it is this paradox where Jewish identity comes from a kind of inadvertent saving grace when you have everything that people usually depend on to establish and maintain their identity. Land, monuments, palaces, castles, military force, whatever, and all that completely disappears. The Jews found a way to actually make the book which defined their identity portable. So it's the notion that the scroll of the Bible, a mixture of stories and ethical norms of laws, could be something you could take with you that could make you into a suitcase-ready religion, was, you know, what happened, and it accounts for this extraordinary kind of epic of endurance.
I'm curious that, and you kind of alluded to something just now as you spoke, just throughout the book, and also, especially since you write so much around the different events that took place in the Bible or in actual history. So, you know, in some ways you can look at this, like people can dismiss the Hebrew Bible as a literalist fiction. Some people can and do. And somewhere in between the myth and the reality of what might be, but also from all, you can look at some of this from the archaeological evidence, from the history that we know from Josephus and others. So how do you, I mean, I know you do this throughout the book, but since people haven't read the book yet, many people have not.
Right.
How
right.
do you make the argument between them? Do you know what I'm saying? I've thought about
it. Yeah, it's very difficult. I think you can't find a kind of place of comfort between, on the one hand, an immense poetic invention, which some, not all of the Bible was, and on the other hand, thinking that it is, you know, a record of literally what happened. It's a history book. You really have to sort of go to particular places and say it's one or the other. Let me give you an example. For example, we have no hard archaeological or any other kind of evidence that the Exodus story, which is, after all, the founding story that creates Jewish identity, did happen. Doesn't mean to say that none of it actually ever happen, because we don't have the evidence. But we don't have the evidence, unlike, for example, the exciting archaeology, which I describe in the book, which makes it clear that there was something like a Jerusalemite or a Judean state at the time, usually associated with the period of King David, the United Monarchy. There we're starting to get evidence of Jewish fortresses and citadels and Hebrew writing and tax records and property seals and all the rest of it. But what you can say about the Exodus story is that in the way in which the Bible writers, many, many hundreds of years after the event it means to describe, what they did was to sew into the story very archaic language. The Song of the Sea, the song that Miriam sings to celebrate the drowning of the Egyptians, is written in an extremely archaic kind of ballad-like Hebrew that has a lot in common with other West Semitic, Canaanite, or Phoenician languages belonging to the 12th or 13th century BC. So you know that even whatever the events whether the events took place or not, the memory of them, the determination to turn them into a founding epic, was very, very ancient. And it's a very complicated way to talk about it. But as you go on in the Bible, the chapter which I mostly join the argument about the Bible, the books of Nehemiah and Ezra, by the time you get to that story of Jews who've been exiled, being allowed by the Persian Empire to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild both the temple and the city walls, then there's a good deal of independent documentary evidence, partly from the so-called cylinder of the Persian king Cyrus, that what the Bible is saying historically actually happened. You must keep, in as you go from moment to moment in the Bible, looking for evidence outside the Bible text itself to see if you're talking about myth or history. It's tricky. It's very tricky. It's easy to confuse the reader. You may have been confused. I'm sure not. Mark.
I'm easily confused.
No, I'm sure you're not.
Because it really has been like it really is a very important part of the discussion because many people can ask the question.
It's easily disposed of if, for example, like the vast majority of the Orthodox, you believe that every word of the Bible is true and much of it dictated by God, and it all without any question represents actual events that actually happened. Then there's no debate. There's no problem. You believe what you believe, and a lot of Christians believe that as well, too. But for many, many hundreds of years, it's been assumed that the Bible was written by humans and by, what's more, many different generations of humans. And since we know that Moses could not possibly have described his own death, then clearly those chapters, those books of the Bible, were not written by Moses himself. And very few people, I think, except the extremely Orthodox, would argue with the basic assumption that the events described early on in the Bible are written up at least a half a millennium, if not much longer, after they actually might have happened.
You make this very strong argument about 3,000 years of both oppression and from various cultures that Jews lived in. Right. And in some cases, people can make a very strong argument for Israel and Zionism from that argument. But right. you can also from what you're writing, that especially in the parts around what happened to Jews between some Arab cultures and the Hellenic cultures, is that the Jews also were kind of integrated and interwoven in all these societies, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely true, I think. That is indeed at the heart of a lot of scholars who are kind of full-time Jewish historians now talk about this. It's a hideous word, acculturation, which is a place between assimilation, which is thought to be basically a freeway to disappearance, and a strong sense that Jews lead a separate life aside from their society. And what we know to be true almost throughout Jewish history is that perfectly devoted religious Jews would actually adopt many of the cultural characteristics of the world they live in. I'll give you one example. Jews in the Greek period, all Jewish boys who grew up with the story of Hanukkah, think of Jewish life and Greek life as absolutely, in every respect, opposite. But that's not the historical record at all. We know one particularly unhinged king managed to trigger the Hasmonean revolt, which is the story celebrated in the Hanukkah festival. But guess what? One of the kings who arise out of that rebellion gives himself the Greek name of Alexander. Jews at that time speak Greek, a common form of Greek. They dress like Greeks. They participate in many things that one think of as Greek cultural literary forms. And most striking of all, and we show this in the second part of our television series, which airs very soon, let me tell you, the first 2 hours of it are going to be on March 25th. But the earliest synagogues we know are full of mosaics. They're full of mosaics, notwithstanding the second commandment, not to indulge in any graven images. These are not graven images, they're mosaics, and even in some cases wall paintings. And these are exactly like paintings that would be seen in pagan temples, or indeed in some very early Christian churches. The first 600 years of the life of the synagogue following the destruction of the temple in the first century AD, the first century CE, are full of images. And those images owe a lot to the surrounding culture. And that's pretty much always been the case.
Because we make this very simplistic discussion in the Jewish world, and I think you would tackle this in a very interesting way. Let's say during the period of the Maccabees,
right?
Because people look at that as a kind of a, in some ways a rising up against a cultured Jewish group that intermingled a great deal with other worlds, as opposed to the world that wanted to oppose that. And
right.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, so that
yeah.
Because there was this huge international world, as you describe it,
right.
of Greek Jewish communities, of Jewish communities that were taken into the Greek culture.
Yeah, then there's a lovely story of, you know, the Hebrew Bible being translated into Greek by a group of rabbis in Alexandria,
right.
which I described in the book. So, you know, what we're talking about is the insurrection against one particular Greek tyrant, king of Syria. But he was extremely unrepresentative. Almost as soon as he'd been disposed of, those who rule Hasmonean Judea make a deal with his descendants, which was a deal which reconstructed the original bargain by which the Kingdom of Judea is a kind of satellite state of a greater Alexandrian Greek power, in return for which the Greeks are perfectly happy to have the Jews worship in the temple exactly as they wished. So there are all these, you know, rather beautiful shades of gray, really, between defiantly separate Jewish existence and complete disappearance inside other people's world.
So some of the question is begged here, was there ever really a completely separate Jewish existence?
The Dead Sea Scrolls, the Qumran community out there in the desert, conceivably. I mean, it's true, Jews will be as separate as they... Very often, Jews are forced to be separate. They're forced to be separate. But if you take, for example, the one thing I would want to stress is that those highly decorated synagogues that I talked about in Galilee, especially, were not places like, you know, super reform synagogues in the United States. The one that we show in our program is the place called Sepphoris or Tzipori, is the place where the Mishnah, one of the most important codifications of Jewish practice, began to receive its final form. So there are so many cases where you have devout, orthodox, extremely passionately religious Jews adopting some of the cultural forms of the host society. Another example, in Muslim Spain, for example, during the 9th, 10th, and 11th centuries, a beautiful new form of Hebrew poetry arises. And some of the Hebrew poetry which happens is intensely spiritual. Some of it, indeed, little bits of it are used in synagogue services now. But some of it is also very earthly and worldly and about erotic love. Hard to imagine, you know, ultra-Orthodox rabbis writing in Hebrew about erotic love now. But Yehuda Levi does that, Samuel Negrela does. And where do they get the models for that? They get it essentially from Arabic literature. So that's one particular example. Jews and Muslims in the high period of the Middle Ages were distinct entities. Jews had to wear a particular kind of dress. Those dress rules were not always enforced. But they could live anywhere they liked, and they could undertake any occupations or professions they liked. So there was absolutely a genuine commingling of Jewish and Muslim worlds, both in North Africa and in Spain.
And of course, whether it was inside the Islamic world, the Hellenistic world, or the their depictions of life in the Near East in the more ancient times, it was always a mixed bag. I mean, it could flow from that kind of congeniality and acceptance in a lot of the Muslim world for different periods in the Middle Ages to just the opposite.
Yeah, I mean these stories. There is no continuous honeymoon. There is no Arcadia. Some of these periods of, you know, what the Spanish call convivencia, sort of coexistence, are punctuated by massacre. There was a terrible massacre of Jews in the Muslim city of Granada in 1066, for example,
right.
Which killed perhaps possibly 4,000 of them as a rebellion against the kind of Jewish chief minister of finance, who was the son of the poet General Negrela. So these things are not without woe, but of course, you know, the lines of calamity run, very deep in Jewish history, and what I was at pains to suggest, and a lot of Jewish historians do this, is that there is much celebration that goes on as well. Again, at the beginning of the medieval program, the second program in the series, it begins with this glorious Bible that's produced in the Spanish port city of Coruña just 16 years before the expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492, but you would never know it. This is a Bible that's absolutely blazing with color and animation and figures and animals and naked bodies, actually, on the signature page, rather amazingly. Mm-hmm. It's the most beautiful thing. And the one thing that happens to you when you think that bad times might be around the corner, you get to kind of really seize the moment with as much intensity as possible. And that also, this sense of kind of vital engagement with the world, has also been characteristic of Jewish history.
And the other part of this that I think is really important to talk about as well is that is the international nature of the Jewish community that took place in the existing, yeah, in the known world, Western Arabic world at that time.
Yes, well, actually, the wanderings of the Jews begin before the destruction, right, of the Second Temple in 70 AD. We know there were colonies in the Greek islands. We know there were probably migrant communities in Persia and what's now Turkey. We know for sure that there were Jews in Rome before the destruction of the Temple in 70. So, that looking for business opportunities and settling, we were really always very footloose. The footlooseness then becomes a penance in some ways. But of course, another of the geniuses, we talked a minute ago about part of the inadvertent genius was to actually make sure that your identity survives through the portable word. Another genius was turning what was regarded as an affliction, and certainly a Christian society thought of the dispersion of the Jews as a punishment for the crime of crucifying Christ. But you can turn dispersion, you can flip it and turn it into an extraordinary advantage. It makes you somewhat at home wherever you go. You have extended family in various places. The chapter about the Cairo Geniza documents.
I was just looking at that. Extraordinary. That's why I opened the book to just this moment.
Yeah, well, it's an extraordinary story because what the letters that pour into Cairo that survive for hundreds of years, because they're tossed aside in this repository, show a kind of world of trading Jews as far apart as the Silk Road to China, the Indian, the West Coast, the Malabar coast of India, all the way through to the tip of the Atlantic Ocean, where it brushes North Africa. So, you can make your globetrotting into an advantage as well as a punishment. And so Jews were, however reluctant they might have been, they led a cosmopolitan life, necessarily.
I'm curious why, there's a lot of new things I've discovered in this book that I did not know, and just the way you describe things, I think, is very well written, really well written. But why did you think this was necessary to do, given all the histories that have taken, that people have written over the centuries?
There are two reasons. One, I think, actually, that and it was done very much in conjunction with making this series of films. I wanted to reach a non-Jewish as well as a Jewish audience. That was very important. And when you get an opportunity to do it on television, you don't really turn aside from that lightly. We had 3 million people tuning in for the early episodes in a country like Britain where there are only 250,000. So we did actually manage to make that connection. And why it was important to make that connection, and still is that when people think about Jewish history, they think about it either in terms very often of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or in terms of the Holocaust. And these are not incidental matters, that's for sure. They're inescapably tremendously important. But I was trying to really find a way to engage people who are not necessarily part of the Jewish world, the world of Jewish memory, in a way that was not completely preempted by these two, the two very tragically loaded, there's an element of glory as well as tragedy in the Israeli story, but two very, very loaded moments. I wanted to kind of open the doors and make it more invitational if I could. And the other thing I'd say, without any disrespect at all to the extraordinary kind of legions of brilliant scholars, and Jewish history is forever being refreshed and replenished by new research and extraordinarily profound and powerful scholarship, but not a lot of it takes the form of a narrative. Admittedly, I was even madder than the eventual project. I thought I could do this in one volume. That was demonstrably clear that that wasn't going to be. So I'm trying to do it in two volumes. Even that is, of course, an enormous handful. But a very distinguished predecessor of mine at Columbia University, where I teach, wrote, if not a definitive, then an extraordinarily exhaustive history of the Jews, Professor Salo Barone, and he wrote in 18 volumes. And nobody is going to read an 18, particularly not today, an 18-volume story of the Jews. So I wanted to really be the next generation on, using the research of scholarship wherever I could, but turn it into a continuous story, a story about the making of stories. I think that's also the other strong emphasis, as you know, in my text.
You also spend, some people you spend a great deal of time with. You mentioned a moment ago, you hit Halevi. You spend a lot of time with him in this
with
book. Halevi.
Oh, with Yehuda Halevi. Yeah. Yes, I do, I guess. I mean, one of the others. Well, I mean, Halevi was, one is in awe, really, of a number of these people from, you know, medieval religious and non-religious literature, and that they, all like Maimonides, they have like four different jobs. I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary. They're at once Bible scholars. Halevi was a very reluctant doctor. You could write the whole history of the Jews in terms of his doctors, I have to say. But he was a doctor who attended to people, and he was at the same time someone who was a kind of intellectual celebrity in the Jewish world and was called on to act as a kind of a rabbi, which he technically was, giving judgments on people's own particular problems, you know, problems that could be arbitrated by Jewish law. So these are Renaissance Jews before there was actually a Renaissance. And it's this extraordinary capability, really, of being at the same time hard, practical men of the world and poets and theological philosophers at the same time that just takes your breath away. The poetry itself, anybody out there who's not familiar, and this is probably a large number of your listeners, not familiar with Hebrew poetry, of the Middle Ages, really, there are a lot of wonderful collections of it, beautifully translated, should really take a look at it, because it's startlingly conversational, direct, powerful, earthy, sexy, spiritually intense. This is, you know, as magnificent a kind of writing as poetry ever could be. And those of you out there who are Jewish and do know Hebrew, you can have fun with there's a penguin anthology in which you can do your own translations from Hebrew on the right to English on the left and see which ones you like. There are high-flown translations and very conversational translations, and that's a lot of fun too. But what this is, it's a real literary revolution. What these people do at the height of the Middle Ages is give an ancient religious language, Hebrew, a new rush of life, just as, you know, great Israeli novelists and writers and poets now give Hebrew yet another life. It's not just the language of Passover and the Day of Atonement. It's a living, breathing language in the pen of these men a long time ago.
So the other person we talk about here, you talk about a lot, is Josephus.
Josephus, right.
Josephus, yeah. Excuse me.
Josephus is very important because actually you never really know whether the Bible is, as I say, history or myth. But in this case, it doesn't matter because the Bible closes before the great rebellion of the Jews against the Romans in the first century AD. And therefore, Josephus, who writes extraordinary books of history, is our only source for what happened in this great Jewish insurrection against the might of the Roman Empire. And he's an incredibly gripping writer as well. And he's somebody who has multiple identities. His one half of his family came from the Jerusalem temple priesthood. The other half of his family came from the royal dynasty of the Hasmonean kings. So he's as Jewish as you can possibly get. He spends some time with a guru in the desert. And so he's very intensely Jewish. And but he's also he's clearly fluent in Latin and Greek and is sent to Rome. And when he comes back, he's given, as a very young man, the command of the northern army of the rebel army of the Jews. And he takes command in a terrible siege, which the Jews are destined to lose. And it looks so grim that he convinces all the officers to commit suicide, but then walks out unscathed himself and promptly joins the Romans. So when we were children, we were taught Josephus was kind of scum of the earth as far as Jews were concerned because he betrayed his own people. But, of course, he felt there was no point, from his point of view, there was no point actually courting destruction for a losing cause. And what makes him so fascinating is precisely his double identity. He goes to Rome. He's sort of adopted by the Emperor Vespasian. He lives in the Emperor Vespasian's apartments. And he expects to be congratulated for his switching sides, but he's condescended to in a way he finds offensive. He discovers that all sorts of scurrilous prejudices are at large and alive and well in Rome. And he decides to write an extraordinary book, which I talk about both in the television program and in the book called Contra Appium, which is designed to stand up tall and say to the Romans, you have all these shocking and defamatory prejudices about the Jews. Here's really what we stand for. So at the end of his life, he achieves a kind of a tremendous dignity. You know, he's among non-Jews, but he sort of stands tall and talks about what it's really about. So he's a fascinating figure.
Sami Sharma, thank you so much for this book, The Story
of the
Jews,
welcome,
and your time today.
Okay, thank you, Mark.
Thank you. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. To hear this show again, podcast past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com.